inaccuracy errors or omissions reported during this program. Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by MetLife and Grantham University. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll bring you special coverage of AFGE's National Convention with TSA Local 556 President Don Thomas and AFL-CIO Executive Vice President Arlene Holt-Baker. We'll also discuss President Obama's decision to continue the federal pay freeze with AFGE National President J. David Cox and Public Policy Director Jackie Simon. President Cox, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Jason. Glad to be back. Actually back in a new role.
Indeed, indeed. You are the new AFGE National President, and coming across your desk just this week, President Obama has chosen to extend the federal pay freeze until Congress adopts a new budget. President Cox, what is your reaction to this?
Right off the bat, Jason, it's unconscionable. It was wrong. It's just not the right thing to do. When I received that news yesterday afternoon, I was just really put back. The president has stood very firm saying that he supported ending the pay freeze. The president, by his power that he has in EFCA, which is a process the president has with establishing federal pay, could have ended the pay freeze. This is just the wrong thing. It's just not acceptable for federal employees.
President Cox, of course, you referenced the Federal Employees Pay Comparability Act that President Obama could have used to give federal employees some sort of pay increase. Why do you think he chose not to exert that authority?
I can't tell you the exact reason. I do believe that it's obviously there's pressure from many, many sides to control the budget. But a point I would really like to bring out today, Jason, as many people will remember, federal employees used to get their pay raise October 1 when the fiscal year for the federal government started. Then back in Mr. Reagan's days, he moved it to January 1, which automatically cut down on the percentage of the pay raise employees would get because it lowered it from the 12 months to a 9-month process. Now we are moving the pay raise even forward more, and if Congress enacts a budget, say, by March or April next year, and at that point, a half of a percentage point is enacted as a pay raise. In reality, it is only 0.25% of a pay raise. So it literally cuts a half percentage point in half, which is just no pay raise at all.
And there might be some listeners out there who would say, okay, we're talking about a half a percent or half of a half a percent, but these figures and these freezes have real impacts on federal workers who, say, make $30,000, $35,000 a year, right?
Yes, sir, and many of them make even less than that, Jason. It's a real financial issue. The price of federal employee health insurance premiums will go up, and it is scheduled to go up, and that'll happen the 1st of January. Those raises will immediately take place without employees having a raise and any ability to deal with it. At the same token, the price of gas, the price of groceries, everything continues to go up, but their income is staying flatline and actually decreasing.
We know that budgets and the way that it works in Congress, it's very fluid, and there aren't many hard and fast dates where we can predict where something might happen. But do you have any idea how long this pay freeze might continue on for federal employees and when a new budget might be adopted?
At this point, no, Jason. Typically, Congress will adopt a budget somewhere after the first of the year. We could conceivably have a Congress that would not adopt a budget the entire year, and if that would be the case, there would be no cost of living adjustment for federal employees. Again, it's a is sort of rolling the dice. And federal employees have given up, and they have forking over $60 billion, while the wealthiest of all wealthy Americans have made no sacrifice. And I am very much aware that many other middle-class Americans have made sacrifices, and there's unemployment and things of that nature. But the wealthiest of the wealthies are continuing to have a whole lot of money and are not ending up any fair share with the tax burden in this country.
And to your point, a great number of federal employees are middle-class Americans. They overlap, right?
Yes, sir, they do. They certainly are.
So we know then for sure that January 1st, healthcare premiums will rise for federal employees. And at this point, it looks like they will not be getting a cost of living adjustment. How does that make you feel?
That's pretty devastating. And I would also point out all brand new hires to the federal government in January will also be paying an additional amount in their retirement with no increase in the annuity later on in their life. So it's a double whammy every way you turn for federal employees. A very, very difficult time.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with AFGE National President J. David Cox. President Cox, of course, you got notice of this earlier this week, and the president sent a letter to Congress stating his intentions. Are you aware of any sacrifices that the contractor workforce might have to make during this time?
Absolutely no sacrifices, Jason. Congress will still pay the contractors whatever price they charge. They will continue to get their pay raises. Things will continue to go very, very well for all of the contractors. And I would certainly remind all of our listeners that there are millions of government contractors out there. There are just millions of them. The government spends a lot more money on contractors than it does the small workforce that it has to operate in the entire federal government.
So this certainly seems to be your first order of business as AFGE National President. What is your response going to be for the union going forward on this issue?
Clearly, as I told the delegates at our convention last week, it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat, a Republican, or an independent. If you are against federal or D.C. government workers, then we are against you, and we will push back, and we will stand up. We will stand up on the fact of anybody, be it the Democratic administration or the Republican Congress, that is saying freeze federal employee pay, do not treat federal employees properly. We will stand up to them. We will call them out, and we will push back.
We mentioned, of course, that health care premiums are going to rise, but so is just standard costs of living for federal employees, rent, food, child care, things of that nature, right?
Yes, sir. Everything continues to go up. We're all very much aware of that process.
That's one reason
we sort of have cost of living adjustments for not just government workers, but most employees throughout the country get some type of cost of living adjustments. That's a pretty standard operating procedure that occurs throughout our country. And to just reach a point to constantly freeze pay and to keep pay frozen for such a long period of time, it's stifling out the economy. There are many, many places in this country where there's military bases, VA hospitals as such, but the largest number of employees of an employer are federal employees. When they have less money, they're spending less money in the community, the money is turning over less, it has an impact upon everyone.
And these cost of living adjustments are just that. They're ways to keep the workforce keeping up with inflation and the cost of rising products. So this certainly puts federal employees in a dangerous situation because, in effect, they're taking a loss then, right, on their paychecks?
That's exactly right. They are. They clearly are. I mean, it doesn't take much to figure those things out, that they're taking a loss. There's less income. And again, we're not talking about freezing contractors' monies that they charge the federal government. We are not talking about raising taxes on the wealthiest of the wealthy in this country that are already not paying their fair share. All of those type things, you know, need to be looked at. Just to always go to the well of federal employees that, hey, they're the ones to take the hit is just an unacceptable stance for anyone to take.
President Cox, you, of course, will be dealing with this in the weeks and months down the road. But as the newly elected president at AFGE, what is the course that you will be plotting for the AFGE membership?
Well, the first one of our top priorities are the fall elections, the presidential race, the Congress, and a third of the Senate is up for election. AFGE will be a critical player and will be out and involved in all of those elections. AFGE's had many friends that are out there, and we will be working for their reelection. AFGE, while I'm telling you point blank, I'm standing up to President Obama today. AFGE has endorsed President Obama for reelection. AFGE will work for his reelection, but AFGE will call him to task when he doesn't do the right thing by federal employees. So that's a number one priority for the next few months for AFGE. But as you know, Jason, I am always the person that will scream and cry, organize, organize, organize. We are really going into a massive organizing mode for our union. Our goal is to break 300,000 members in the very near future. So that's going to be also a large priority of mine, as well as making AFGE the house whole word. When you say AFGE, you don't have to explain. That's the government employees union. People know that that's AFGE. That's the government workers, and they're out there working on the behalf of all the American public as well as their members every day.
President Cox, can you explain a little bit what goes into organizing a group of workers and the effort that it takes to make that a reality?
Well, Jason, I think you're very much aware of the TSA organizing campaign was well over a 10-year process, and it is a very, very long process. Number one, seeking out workers. Do they want to form a union, to vote to have a union? Then after they voted, you still got to bargain a contract. You have many, many issues to move forward. And then because all the federal government is an open shop, you still have to go out and recruit members and entice people to voluntarily join the union and pay union dues. So there's a lot of work in that process. We have to be very, very customer-oriented in what we do, very, very customer-oriented. And I hate to use that word to referring to our members as customers, but they are. We have to be ready to respond to their concerns, represent them, fight in Congress legislatively on behalf of their pay and benefits, and to bargain those good contracts. We have to we have to deliver goods for people to be a member of this union.
Over the last several years, AFGE has experienced explosive growth in its membership drives. What do you think draws federal employees to AFGE?
I think a commonality. Number one, people like the representation that AFGE provides. Number two, they realize we are the only entity in this country that fights for government employees. That's our sole interest, is working on the behalf of government employees. They're all type entities that move political agendas and legislation and all type of causes. AFGE is the only entity that exists in this country that is fighting on the behalf of federal workers.
AFGE National President J. David Cox. President Cox, thank you so much for coming on the show today and joining us.
Thank you so much, Jason. I certainly appreciate it. The best of luck to you, and have a great day.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue the federal pay freeze discussion with AFGE Public Policy Director Jackie Simon.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. To see how much you could save, call the AFGE Benefits Hotline at 1-888-844-2343 to get the members-only phone number for MetLife. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
I just earned my degree at Grantham University, and now I'm on my way to a promotion.
Grantham University?
The affordable online classes fit my schedule, plus I earn college credit for work experience.
How can I fast-track my degree at Grantham University?
Go to fasttrackedu.com.
Fasttrackedu.com?
Yes, fasttrackedu.com. If you're an AFGE member, you qualify for a tuition discount. Check out Grantham University today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Jackie Simon, AFGE's Public Policy Director. Jackie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Jackie, we just spoke with AFGE National President J. David Cox about President Obama's decision to extend the federal pay freeze until Congress adopts a new budget. From a policy standpoint, what does this decision mean for federal employees?
Well, what it means is that the president has decided, after advocating for almost a year for ending the pay freeze and giving federal employees a very, very small, almost insultingly small pay increase of 0.5%, he's decided to cut that 0.5% in half, at least, by delaying any possibility for a pay adjustment to the end of the continuing resolution, which would probably be in April. You know, that's halfway through the fiscal year, and so it essentially is only a half a year of pay raise.
So
it never happens.
Maybe to the average listener, a half of a 0.5% numbers seem kind of small. They might think that there isn't much of an impact, but this is going to have real consequences for federal employees, correct?
It has numerous consequences. Of course, the worst consequences are on federal employees' paychecks. They've already been frozen for 2 years, and adding another at least 4 months or longer to that pay freeze is just unbelievable, especially in light of the fact that, you know, when it comes to deficit reduction, no other group of Americans, nobody else has made any kind of sacrifice, only federal employees. Now, we know with sequestration looming that there are many others who are threatened with, you know, horrible reductions in services and benefits from the federal government. So soon we won't be alone, but at this point we still are. And so now federal employees not only have the pay freeze extended, but they've got this extremely nerve-wracking threat that from sequestration simultaneously. And it's just, he's thrown us to the wolves, and it's outrageous. It was a completely gratuitous gesture. There's just no justification for it.
Once a new budget is adopted, are there any safeguards in place to guarantee that federal employees get an increase?
No.
So then they could be looking at a pay freeze indefinitely.
Well, as most listeners probably know, if some version of the House Republican budget, the one that the vice presidential nominee, Ryan, takes responsibility for, there will absolutely be another year of pay freeze and possibly another 3 years of pay freeze for a total 5-year pay freeze. That's what is in his budget.
That's a tough pill to swallow for a federal employee, one who may be making $30,000, $35,000, $40,000 a year.
Yeah, I mean it's kind of outrageous when you think about the choices federal employees have in this upcoming election. They've got, one party that has, at least in the House, adopted a budget that's extremely harsh toward federal employees, would reduce the number of federal employee jobs. You know, any budget's going to have these spending caps from the Budget Control Act, which might lead to, you know, furloughs from sequestration, a pay freeze. You know, they're still threatening to increase the amount federal employees have to pay for retirement benefits. And, you know, then you've got another party that promised an end to the pay freeze but just decided yesterday, you know, well, let's just extend it a little longer. It won't hurt that much. Well, guess what? It does hurt that much. But these are our choices.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Jackie Simon, AFGE's Public Policy Director. Jackie, earlier you mentioned the amounts that federal employees have already contributed to deficit reduction. Are there any statistics to show what this continued pay freeze would do in terms of deficit reduction?
Oh, it would be fairly small. You know, $30 billion a year when it's a whole year. So, you know, it's maybe another $15 billion just, you know, off the top of my head. You know, one of the things that we have tried to tell the administration that's especially unjustifiable is the fact that, you know, federal employees have been asked to, you know, sustain this pay freeze, not going now on more than 2 years, but federal contractors, who are a larger federal workforce than the direct federal workforce, not only have not had any pay freeze during the last 2 years, they've had pay increases. They have more generous benefits in many cases than federal employees do, and they're not being asked to sacrifice one red cent. While we have taken our hits, employees hired after January 1st, 2013 will pay vastly more for their retirement benefits than current federal employees. And this is just a direction of declining standard of living for federal employees that's just, you know, it makes absolutely no sense. It's, you know, sort of political theater, and they are pretending that the people who are affected matter not at all, when, of course, we do matter.
As you mentioned earlier, Jackie, of course, come January 1st, healthcare premiums for federal employees will be increasing as well. Do you have any idea how much those premiums will increase?
No, the premium increases, you know, the OPM and the insurance companies would tell you that it's the market and the risk characteristics of the population that determine the premium increases. But politics plays a huge role, too. Do they want to fly under the radar and not have too much attention placed on their premiums, or do they, you know, want to grab as much money as they possibly can every single year? In years where they want to avoid attention and the risk of any kind of controls on their ability to charge what they want, sometimes they moderate their demands for increase. But one thing we always know, and that is that OPM rubber stamps anything the insurance companies ask for. So it's really pretty much 100% whatever Blue Cross Blue Shield wants it gets. We will certainly ask the administration, in light of their brilliant idea to extend the pay freeze, to freeze federal employees' obligations under FEHBP at 2012 levels, at least until there's any kind of pay increase, because it's ridiculous. We've had rising health insurance premiums every year of the freeze, and it's just a constant decline in standard of living for federal employees, who are already underpaid both in terms of salaries and benefits, regardless of what the Heritage Foundation might want to tell you.
And through a lot of your research, Jackie, I think we've learned that the government is passing a lot of these increases more and more on to federal employees every year. Is that right?
That is correct. Every year, it's a gradual and small shift, but it is a shift, and it's been relentless over the last more than a decade, where once upon a time, the federal government, on average, paid about 32% of premiums. Now it's under 30%. Somewhere, anywhere, it goes, depending on the plan, anywhere from 27 to 29%.
Jackie Simon, AFGE's Public Policy Director. Jackie, always great to have you on the show. Thanks for coming on and sharing some of these statistics with us today.
My pleasure. Take care.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll take a look back at AFGE's recent national convention with AFL-CIO Executive Vice President Arlene Holt-Baker.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. To see how much you could save, call the AFGE Benefits Hotline at 1-888-844-2343 to get the members-only phone number from MetLife. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
I just earned my degree at Grantham University, and now I'm on my way to a promotion.
Grantham University?
The affordable online classes fit my schedule. Plus, I earn college credit for work experience.
How can I fast-track my degree at Grantham University?
Go to fasttrackedu.com.
Fasttrackedu.com?
Yes, fasttrackedu.com. If you're an AFGE member, you qualify for a tuition discount. Check out Grantham University today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by AFL-CIO Executive Vice President Arlene Holt-Baker. Ms. Baker, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much, Jason. So happy to be here, and happy to be here with you in Los Angeles, you know, Las Vegas at your convention.
And we are very excited to have you, of course. You were the keynote speaker here this afternoon at AFGE's National Convention. Tell me what your main message was to the membership here today.
The message to the membership today was the fact that we are in such a crisis in America. And as we look at what's happening to all workers, but particularly as I address the AFGE workers, talking about what's happening to government workers, the very fear that we have is that the direction that our country could possibly go in if we were to elect a Romney-Ryan ticket would be one that would really gut public services as we know it and would end up with a possibility of over 200,000 government jobs being lost, which is beyond just the people, but it's the actual safety net that those jobs provide for American citizens. So it was a message of understanding who's on our side and who's there for real shared prosperity for all Americans and not just the 1%.
The choices are very clear. There are very stark contrasts between the candidates and, as you had mentioned, a lot of services, a lot of public services at stake here.
Absolutely, the public services that we look at. You think about Medicare and Medicaid in terms of what we would have with a Romney-Ryan presidency and vice presidency, which would be very frightening to us. We know that Paul Ryan has already indicated in his budget that he would really support it before the privatization of Social Security. We know he wants to cut a lot out of Medicare itself and turn it over to the states. We know that would not work out so well for so many people who are in need because states, especially with their budgets being what they are today, would decide to put a lot of people off of the system. So the crisis is at hand. The safety net is a big concern. It's about Medicare. It's certainly about Medicaid. It's about Social Security. It's about the three-legged stool in so many ways for people.
And our AFGE members, of course, D.C. and federal government employees have been thrown in to this being politicized in many ways along the way. And something that you had mentioned in your speech, federal work should not be politicized.
It should not be politicized. And what we should be trying to do in this country is a way to ensure that we have good quality public service. That is a testament to the strength of our country, the strength of our democracy. It is so disturbing, Jason, that what has happened, and we've seen it especially in the course of the last year with the right wing, this attack on the public sector so that they can featherbed, if you will, the private sector and let them be the benefactors. And I'm not talking about poor workers who get exploited when they're working in the private sector. I'm talking about the privatization of public services. That is the intent. that they have, and our intent is to not let them get there to do it.
And you brought up a great point in your speech along the idea of privatization, that actually federal employees are more efficient.
Absolutely, more efficient, and at the end of the day, the cost is even less with both. Now, initially, they go in and they give you these bids and they say we can do it for less. But over a course of time, you go back 4 years from the time they've been awarded a contract, and it is increased, and it is even higher than it was with public servants doing the job. Privatization is not a formula that works. The calculus does not work, but it benefits those contractors. On average, today, the average contractor is getting over $230,000 annually. I said it today. Do you know that that's what the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, makes? Now, quite frankly, I think that Vice President Biden deserves his $230,000. But $230,000 on average for these contractors when you throw in the salaries and other benefits. You tell me that when you compare that with government workers, that their cost isn't higher in the end, calculus doesn't work.
And government workers, as we know, they take an oath before starting their jobs. They're in this for the service part of it, to make millions of dollars.
They are not. Public servants are just that. They do not, Jason, go into the jobs because they are trying to get rich. They know they're not. But they do expect to work and get a decent wage with a sustainable wage and the ability to retire with dignity. And for AFGE workers who are so fortunate to be in a union, they have been able to negotiate and bargain over these conditions. And so all we're saying for federal workers and all workers, quite frankly, all workers want is a fair shot here, and they want to be able to bargain collectively so that they don't have to borrow their way into the middle class or beg their way into the middle class, but be able to negotiate themselves there.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Arlene Holt-Baker, the AFL-CIO's Executive Vice President. Arlene, another note that you made to the audience today was, our democracy is under attack. With that in mind, what is the AFL's plan going into the election season?
What we have seen, Jason, over the course of the last 2 years, actually after President Obama's election in 2008, we have seen the introduction of voter ID laws introduced in over 38 states in this country. We now know that the intent behind these voter laws, and they are simply voter suppression laws and a modern-day poll tax, is to reduce the turnout among poor people, people of color, and young people. The very coalition of votes that elected President Barack Obama in 2008. Now, there is no evidence of voter fraud in our country. Even under the Bush administration, when investigation was done, they could not find it. It was so very minute that the numbers weren't there. And they said it's nothing there. But these folk are indicated that there was a problem, and they have a solution for a problem that does not exist. There isn't a problem. The intent here is to suppress votes among a particular group of people. In this country, still the greatest democracy in the world, if we can keep it, we should be making it easier for people to vote. And so what we will be doing at the AFL-CIO, in the cases of places like Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Florida, where they have introduced these voter suppression laws, we will be doing everything in the courts to try to get them repealed, joining with our other civil rights advocates. But if we're not able to, we're not counting on the courts. We are going to do everything within our power to educate potential voters, to make sure that they know how to get the state-issued ID, and they turn out in mass to make sure that they can overturn these laws in their states eventually.
With regards to some of these laws being implemented throughout the states, you mentioned reference to modern-day poll tax, and I'm not quite sure that people out there really understand what that means, but you gave a great story about your experience with your mother growing up.
Yes, poll tax before 1965 with the passage of the Voting Rights Act, which basically impacted those southern states. Southern states imposed a poll tax, and that poll tax certainly disadvantaged people of color. And they would have to pay a tax. It could be as $2. $2 at that time was an awful lot of money for people who barely made any wages at all. But the intent there was to suppress the votes and make sure that African Americans did not turn out to vote. The same intent that they had when you'd have to go through literacy tests. So the poll tax and the literacy tax tests were combined. And so silly things like how many bubbles in a bar of soap. Well, this is something that people of color would have to take, and of course others did not. So it was in clear intent to suppress the vote. I reference my own mother because in 1965, I was 14 years old. 1965 was when we passed the Voting Rights Act and got rid of the poll tax. But before 1965, my mother had always paid her poll tax. My mother was a domestic worker. She made much less than $5 a day, much less. And after she paid, and we used to then call it car fare, but that was transportation on the bus, it would sometimes be about $3.50 a day. Mother always paid, made the sacrifice to pay the poll tax. And as a child, I remember asking her once for a pair of shoes, much needed pair of shoes. And she told me, "Arlene, I cannot afford to buy your shoes nor get them out of layaway because I have to pay my poll tax first." Mother was going to make sure she participated in her democracy. It should not have had to be that difficult for my mother. It should not have to be. After 1965, it wasn't. And so we've got to make sure that we do everything possible, Jason, so that we don't return to those days. When I say modern-day poll tax today, in order to get state-issued ID, people say, "Oh, ID, that's easy." But do you understand that in America, 11% of our population, which translates into 23 million Americans, primarily people of color, poor people, and young people between the ages of 18 and 24 years old, do not have state-issued ID. Well, you say everybody has a driver's license. No, everybody doesn't have a driver's license because if you don't have an automobile, you can't get you don't have a driver's license. And a driver's license costs money. But in order to prove who you are, you've got to get a birth certificate. And the average cost of a birth certificate is $35. That is a lot of money. So $35 for the cost of the birth certificate, the cost of public transportation to get to a site that you may be able to apply. That is not cost effective for millions in our country, especially with millions and millions being unemployed. So we've got to make sure, as I said, that we need to overturn the laws where they exist. But the only way we can do that is through the courts, but not rely on that. Do everything within our power to make sure people turn out, show up with ID, and the AFL-CIO, we will be working with our partners doing everything, including helping them find ways to support their getting the necessary ID so that they can cast their vote this election cycle and beyond.
As we close out here, one last point that you made to the crowd was the importance of fostering young leaders within the labor movement. Talk about that importance as we move forward, not through just this election, but in years to come.
Absolutely. The future of our movement is the young people. And we've got to open up our doors and our leadership at every level, at the staff level, in order to allow them to be in. Because if we don't, our movement will not survive. They are innovative. They've got some new ideas. They're on the social networking. And we've got to be willing and ready to hear the voices of the young people and let them lead us into a movement that is going to propel us into a society of shared prosperity for all. I'm counting on the young people to ensure that we not only survive as a labor movement, but that our democracy survives.
Arlene Holt Baker, the Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO, we certainly thank you for your time here on the show today, as well as taking the time to address our membership here at the convention.
Thank you so much, Jason. It was a wonderful pleasure.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue from AFGE's National Convention with AFGE TSA Local 556 President Don Thomas.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined again by Don Thomas, the president of AFGE's Local 556, the Transportation Security Administration. Don, welcome back to the program.
Hey, great to be back, man.
Don, a lot of good things happening for TSOs these days. Of course, AFGE was successful in negotiating a contract with the agency, the first ever labor contract for the nation's 45,000 transportation security officers. Tell me about the contract.
Oh, man, the contract is going to be awesome. It's one of the things that we've been waiting for 9 years. Basically, all the TSOs will get something out of it, members and non-members, but the membership is going to be the one that's going to get most of it out of it, because members will be appreciated now and actually have a say what's going on in TSA. A lot of committees will be TSA appointees. TSA will have committees with the TSOs and the FSDs and all the people at TSA up in the upper management of TSA. So we're excited about that, actually trying to not just hitting TSA over the head with everything, but actually working with them. Because right now, the fight with the political fight right now is we have to be together. With all the privatization talk and MICA and all the different companies coming, people coming after us, we have to be stronger together. And some of the managers at TSA is actually coming on board with that. And it's kind of exciting. Plus, we have our regular fights. We'll have our regular labor issues, of course. But knowing that you got some people at TSA that can see that we're in this together and to save America, that's what we're all about anyway. So.
That's an interesting concept, bringing on some of the managers who want to come in and work with you a little bit. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I've been working for the past 3 or 4 months in Florida. I've been working with the FSDs in Florida on advisory meetings, and we've been talking about the contract. And I, first, it was always around. We always dumped everything on management. You got to fix this. These guys are wrong. But I never saw their side of it, how they thought about, you know, how can the union help you guys? For example, one of the things we're getting from the contract is the 3-day doctor's note policy for people to have that 3 days and a doctor's note. Normally you have to have 1 day, and people are going paying co-payments and everything. And it's a hassle for them because they got to keep monitoring this, getting people's doctor's notes, writing AWOLs for people. So this is going to help them because the rules are going to be set, and they have the rules on both sides. So they say, hey, look, we can actually work together with this because it's a problem for us. Administrating all that paperwork that needs to be done. So this is one of the issues that it will help them out. For example, the awards committees, we will be working with them on awards, giving out the awards for TSOs, and they're part of it. So it'll be three people from the locals and three people from the management working together on giving out awards. It's always complained that the same people get the same awards, but now working with the managers and the FSDs, we can actually work together and get it spread out to the whole workforce.
Do you think that the contract not only allows a lot of structure for the officers, but also for management as well? They now know what they have to do, what they have to follow by law.
Exactly. And that's going to be because normally there's been no rules, so people have been playing around the game, jumping off the lines. Now we got a rule book. It's like playing football. We got a rule book now. So, you know, you can't jump the rules. There's a penalty for if you're going to offsides, whatever. Now we got the rule book to enforce the rules. Before, we didn't have it. So they're excited about that. I was shocked when I talked to them guys privately and then what they want. course, as they go up higher up the ladder, some people up there, well, oh, no, we can't meet with you guys and everything like that. But as a local level, these guys, we're in it together. They know we're on the local level. The local level is what's going to keep people safe. And down below from the management level, all the guys at the airport, we're the first line of defense. And they got to keep us motivated at all times. So this contract will do that on both sides. So they're a little happy, too, that some of the workers are going to be more motivated now without them trying to use storm arm tactics for management. Or now with the contract, for example, another thing, for example, our uniforms. So, you know, you want to look good when you want to go to work. You want to feel good, you know. And now we have opportunity because we got fresh new uniforms. You got uniforms that are clean. Uniforms that are nice because you used to get three pair of pants and three shirts and you have to keep washing them over and some are torn. The pants is all beat up. You're trying to put a pin in the back. Now you got five or six pair that you can wear now instead of wearing the three. So these are small things that make me feel good because I don't have to worry about my pants falling off or holes in my pants, you know.
When you look good, you play good, right?
Exactly. Look good, play good.
So let's talk about some of the particulars of the contract. When you look at it as a whole, what's the one thing that stands out to you the most as the biggest win for the workers?
I think the biggest one is the third party, bringing the third party in. Fundamental to everything. Fundamental to the union, fundamental to the workers, that they actually have a third party looking at what happened. We all know there's three sides to the story. So you know that story. There's their side, our side, and the truth. So we need to have somebody outside of the agency looking at what happened. That is the fundamental. That is the best part of the contract that I think. And it's so exciting because it starts on November 1st, and that's my birthday. So I'm really excited.
Going back to that part of the contract, when you go through again and you look at everything that you had to fight for to achieve, what do you think the hardest article was to win?
The hardest article was that third party. That's where we lost a lot of good workers because we didn't have that third party. And it was based on someone liking you or someone don't like you and not based on the truth. And TSA is for, you know, I'm not saying all managers are bad. Like I said, I've been talking to them. For example, in MCO, we have 30-something managers. So a fraction may be bad, but all the rest of them guys are pretty good guys. So, but they get lumped in the same area. They're trying to work with us too. So now it gives them a playing field to play in. Now, we have to write those disciplines right. You can't have anything wrong because it's going to a third party now. So all the managers out there, you're going to have to make sure everything is tight, make sure everything's kosher because you're going to a third party that's looking at this. If anything is wrong, you're going to get thrown out. So that's very important.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Don Thomas, the president of AFGE's Local 556, the Transportation Security Administration down in Orlando, Florida. Don, when you are going through the contract and looking at it piece by piece, what do you think the biggest benefit will be to your local at 556?
There's a couple things, but like I said, the third party is the number one. Getting rid of the PASS program, for example, is another one that's going to be benefit. Because we take tests every year. We call them PSEs. And that was part of your bonus money. So you're testing, and you miss one spec of the test, you'll get dinged. So one part of a test, you can lose $1,500.
And that's one thing on one day, right?
One day. So 1 hour, I used to call them the 1 hour bonus, you know. 1 hour bonus is going to determine your whole year. You can come to work every day for a year and don't miss a day, don't miss any day of work. But that 1 hour, if you mess up on any part of the practicals, you miss one section of somebody's body, they call it a ding. You can get dinged and you flunk the test. So we're tested pretty hard. I believe in the test, and we need to be tested. But it shouldn't count as a bonus part. It shouldn't count against your money at the end of the year because it's only a one-time thing. The rest of your year should be the part that judges you as a TSO.
Let's take a look at the issue of privatization. That's a big deal. And some members of Congress, particularly in the House, are really pushing to privatize many airports around the country. Where does that issue stand today?
Well, that issue is in our face in Orlando, of course, in Sanford, and Florida, and Sarasota. So that's Mike, who's the ringleader of this coalition against privatization. He's got his army out trying to make us look bad, but privatization is bad for the whole country. For example, I'm going to use New York. New York had a TSO or somebody didn't check the machine. The machine wasn't plugged in. So the difference between private and us now, we dumped the whole side of the airport. We got everybody back. We took time out to rescan everybody. We didn't care how much it cost because the government is like, safety first, safety first. Now, as a private company, because it's going to cost money, would the private company do the same thing or would they just hush it under the thing? So that's the difference between private and private company. We'll have to pay millions of dollars because, you know, five flights cost millions of dollars. So it's the private company is going to be responsible for that, and they would be responsible for that machine because that was an employee mistake, and they will be held accountable, not TSA, not the government. So that's it. That would be based on them.
How dangerous is it for airports around the country to become privatized?
It would be seriously dangerous because you have new people coming in. We have stuff every day that we've been trained on for 9 years. We've been trained for 9 years now of look what to look for. Every day there's new items coming out. There's new explosives. There's new things coming out. We have to look and be. We're on the computers that we've been trained at for 9 years. I've been there 9 years, and I'm still learning something new. And another thing for people don't realize, it's not even safety. It's a customer service part because bringing new people in now, they're not trained. So you think the lines are long now. Having somebody else right now, the average new person is taking 3 to 4 minutes per person. When they come in for the first couple of months, they spend a couple of minutes on each person. Now, if you got 150 people in line, you got a guy spending 5 minutes, 3 to 4 minutes on one person, that is a problem. That's going to be huge because these new people are coming in, not trained fully and not know what to look for. They're raw, and they're going to be careful because they're new. Nothing wrong against it, but they're going to be careful because they're new too. So having to train people that are already, we are sufficient at what we do. We don't get everything. It's impossible. We'll have some slip-ups, but 450 million people fly all the time, and you have one or two incidents. I think we're doing pretty good. You know.
What's your favorite thing about being a TSO?
My favorite thing about TSO is that I get to interact with the people, and I get to actually save people's lives every day. It's a very huge responsibility, but I cherish it because I know doing my work is saving somebody's lives. So.
Do you think the flying public understands the enormous pressure that you all are under keeping them safe as they fly every day?
No, I don't think they fully understand. Some people do understand that come through. We get a lot of compliments that comes through, but there's that one group that has no clue what we do. For example, we have to learn or we have to know procedures. For example, I give an example. On a wheelchair procedure, we have numerous steps we have to clear somebody on a wheelchair, and I have to know all those steps. It's over 40 steps to clear somebody, and I can't get into what they are, but I have to know. So then I have to jump around and go to another step and learn something else. So 80 or 90 things I must know in a day, in an average day. So,
now that the contract has been agreed upon and going through some formalities along the way, what are you most looking forward to as a TSO now that you have a contract in place?
Now that I have a contract, that our TSO workforce will be energized more to be more efficient and more safe and make it safe for everybody even more. That they know that some of the basics rights are taken care of. For example, if you got your basics taken care of at home, you know your home is safe, you know your kids are safe at home like that, you don't worry about it. But if you have to worry about your shoes and your house not being taken care of and the houses with waters and all and those things, you're distracted. So one thing about the contract is taking distractions away. Some of the distractions that we have, pay, uniforms, a right to work, or, you know, being heard or being honestly, my job is kind of safe now that I can actually fight for my job if something happens. I got somebody on my side to fight for me, and I know that's taken care of. So if I do something or perceive to do something wrong, may not be my fault. I got somebody that's going to fight for me to make sure that everything is kosher.
That must be a good feeling.
That's a great feeling. It's an awesome feeling. I can't describe how it feels. Plus, be working on this thing for 9 years. So, and AFG has been, you know, they've been a partner. AFG has taken care of a lot of people, and a lot of people don't know this. You know, we save people's lives, and AFG saved people's lives too. So, wasn't for them, I wouldn't be here doing what I'm doing.
Don Thomas, the local president for AFGE's TSA 556 in Orlando, Florida. Don, thank you for your time, your service to the American people, and your dedication to AFGE.
My pleasure.
Thank you to our guests this week, AFGE National President J. David Cox, Public Policy Director Jackie Simon, and TSA Local 556 President Don Thomas. Also thank you to AFL-CIO Executive Vice President Arlene Holt Baker. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by MetLife and Grantham University.